You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Arno. E whai ahine coming up on the show. Spike reports on Saturday's Palestinian Solidarity March in Auckland and Aotearoa's role in the ongoing occupation of Gaza, speaking to attendees and Palestinian Solidarity Network Aotearoa head John Minto. Arno, what have you got for us today?
I speak to physics professor and former president of the Royal Astronomical Society, Nick Rattenbury, on the discovery of new starless planets, and Deborah Hart on a new Consumer Advocacy Council submission to require a best plan notice on power bills. And NZ Breast Cancer Foundation chief Arlene Rayner on a new breast cancer awareness campaign.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today. So get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or give us a call in the studio on 09309 3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero āno hi pakihiri rokiroki maoranga i te pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho. Me haere ki 95BFM, Ira Kati Com. Catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
95BFM attended the Palestinian Solidarity March in Tamaki Makaurau last weekend, where 3,000 people marched down Queen Street in protest of the Israeli government's war on Gaza and the ongoing occupation of Palestine. I spoke to attendees about their thoughts on the events in Gaza and why they were marching that day.
We're here for Palestine. We're supporting especially Gaza, especially after what has happened recently. So that's why we're here today.
I'm here today because it's been 75 years since the illegal occupation of Palestine has occurred. And in recent days, there's been a killing of so many children. Then the media continues to portray that it's a war between two equal sides, but we can't ignore that one side has all of the resourcing and the other side, the Palestinian side, are people who are resisting an illegal occupation. So we're here to support the cause. We're Palestinian. We're of Palestinian heritage. It's been a heavy week just trying to get through.
I'm just here to stand in solidarity with people I believe are oppressed. They're not getting as much attention as they should from the whole world, unfortunately. It's raising awareness and expressing my views on the situation. And it's mostly just condemnation of what's happening.
Alhamdulillah, today we came to attend the protest for our brothers and sisters in Palestine through everything they're going through. One thing I believe is, I think people have a big misconception of what's happening, and they're believing that Palestine are the oppressors and Israel are the good people, when you can't beat a wasp nest and not expect to get stung. You know, you can't oppress people for 75 years, you can't beat them into a corner and expect them not to hit back, you know. And once they finally have, the Western media is completely covering the Palestinian people being terrorists and crazy people, and Israel is the good people, you know. But yes, so by the grace of God, I was able to attend. I'm from Hamilton, so it was a bit of a trip, but yes, it was worth it.
The rapid escalation in Israeli violence following Hamas's attack has been catastrophic, with thousands of Palestinian civilians killed by bombing raids and over 300,000 troops now preparing for a ground invasion of northern Gaza. I spoke to Palestinian Solidarity Network Aotearoa chair and former Springbok Tour protest leader John Minto about their latest Israeli actions in Gaza.
Well, in the past week, the Israeli government have been committing war crimes against the Palestinian people of Gaza. They are applying collective punishment to 2.3 million people for the actions of a very small group of Hamas fighters. They have been depriving the people of food and water, and these are war crimes under the Fourth Geneva Convention. Now, Israel did suffer a military attack from Hamas, which involved some civilians being killed. We condemn that. We always condemn the killing of civilians, no matter who they are. It is a war crime under the Fourth Geneva Convention. But then Israel goes on and uses that as an excuse to commit its own war crimes. And the Palestinian people have been the victims here for 75 years. And we should be standing with the victims, not with the oppressor.
We're really counting the hours, just seeing what's happening. I mean, half of the people that we know there have tried to evacuate and weren't even able to get there because they were bombed as they were evacuated. And the other half have decided to stay home, and at least that way they'll die dignified with their families. So it's really not a choice when you have to run away and get bombed or stay at home and get bombed. It's horrific. We're counting the hours just to see what happens, and we're hoping that by standing in solidarity today, the governments will take action.
It's terrorism. It's inhumane. It's something we will look back to years from now and just be in awe of the whole world not reacting as they should.
Well, there's been some pretty inhumane things that have been done recently. We have evidence of chemical weapons like white phosphorus being used. We know that electricity and water has been cut to almost 2 million people, and they're now being effectively ordered to force march within 24 hours. All of these things constitute a genocide. So I'm here against the genocide of the Palestinian people.
Yeah, there's always been brutal oppression of Palestinians in Gaza. This goes back 75 years when Palestinians, back to 1948, 75 years ago, when Palestinians were driven off their land by heavily armed militias in the area which is now southern Israel. It was southern Palestine then. They were driven off their land and into this tiny enclave behind a security fence, essentially a prison for Palestinian people. And Israel refuses to allow them to return to their land and their homes, despite the refugees having the right to do that under international law. So for 75 years, Israel has kept this chokehold on Palestinian people in Gaza, and they've ramped up that 16 years ago by putting a siege on. So everything that goes in and out of Gaza has to come through Israel or smuggled through some other way. So Palestinians have just suffered the most egregious denial of their rights in every aspect by Israel, and especially over the last year under the new right-wing government, which Israel's put in place. Yeah, the new far-right government has ramped up pressure on Palestinians across the board, and it has made life almost unbearable for them wherever they are in Palestine. It has tightened controls and restrictions on Palestinians across the board. So that, for example, 250 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli Defense Force up until last weekend, you know, the highest number for a number of years. The settler movement, these are Israelis living in illegal Israeli-only settlements on Palestinian land, they have been subject to attacks by settler groups.
I asked attendees of the march their thoughts on New Zealand's relationship with Palestine and how the recent conflict has been viewed and responded to here.
I would say New Zealand has been more progressive than most Western countries, and I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about specific political parties today. But there are definitely some that support Palestine and identify that it is under threat, but there are other political parties that just don't want to talk about it. We could do better. New Zealand has always been a progressive country, so I know that we can do better.
That really saddens me. Especially when I have brothers that I know personally who are from Palestine, and it's their family and their siblings and aunties and uncles being killed brutally, you know, for something being oppressed for. It's modern day colonization, and me as a Muslim Maori, I can say that I'm a product of colonization. And for my even Polynesian, my Maori brothers and sisters, for them to support Israel when their ancestors have been through colonization, it's quite sad to see when, you know, they condemn it, but when it happens to another people that isn't them, they ride with it, you know.
New Zealand is very much under a rock. No one in it knows what's happening outside the islands or Australia. So they very much, if it doesn't affect them personally, no one speaks up. As you can see, it was all the Muslims here today because we're the ones getting affected. Ethnic people who come from outside are very aware of what's happening in the world. New Zealand isn't.
Oh, New Zealand has been the problem, along with other Western countries. We are responsible for the violence which is happening in the Middle East now. We are responsible. And we are responsible because we have refused to act to put constraints on Israel, to hold Israel to account for war crimes over such a long time. Israel has been emboldened to attack Palestinians, knowing that none of the Western world is going to speak out. The only thing we can be absolutely certain of is that in the long run, Palestine will be free. Palestinians will get their freedom. What that looks like, when we can't be sure at the moment. But what we should be pushing for is what Palestinians are asking us to do. They're not asking us to send them guns. They're asking us to use non-violent pressure on our government and on Israel to change its policies. They're asking for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. In other words, New Zealanders standing on the side of human rights against what Israel's doing. Every human rights group in the world, every major one, they say that Israel is an apartheid state. They say it is a regime of Jewish supremacy. Wherever Palestinians are in historic Palestine, they face brutal oppression, they face racism, they face apartheid laws, and Palestinians want us to react to that in the way we reacted to the oppression of Black South Africans under apartheid. Black South Africans asked us for international support and solidarity. They asked us for boycotts. New Zealand responded eventually in a positive way. We need to respond to Palestinians in a positive way now.
I think if no one acts immediately, then there will be no Palestine anymore because they're ordering all the people in Gaza to evacuate. And if Gaza is gone, then there won't be any Palestine left because that's the only piece of land that we have left. Thank you.
And that was Spike reporting on the recent Palestinian Solidarity March in Auckland and the ongoing occupation of Gaza, speaking to attendees and Palestinian Solidarity Network Aotearoa head John Minto.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Our traditional model of the universe has always said that planets are formed with an accompanying solar system. That is, most stars have their own planets and most planets have their own stars. However, scientists have suggested that starless planets may exist. Now, a new telescope has taken images to prove that this is indeed the case. The James Webb Space Telescope has captured not one, but two planets orbiting each other far away from the gravity of a sun. To find out more about this and what it means for us, I spoke to Dr. Nick Rattenbury, a senior professor at the University of Auckland and the former president of the Royal Astronomical Society of New Zealand. I started our interview by asking how these planets formed.
So these are observations which have been made by the James Webb Space Telescope. This is an incredible new instrument which has been launched. It has a segmented mirror so that the mirror's about 6.5 meters across, but it's made up of individual bits, and it operates in the infrared. This gives us a different window, if you like, into the universe and the things in it. It is able to look through the clouds of gas and dust and produce images of incredible detail. And in some of these images, they've discovered pairs of objects which have been identified as planets. And they're orbiting around each other, but they are not orbiting themselves around a star. So typically we recognize, or we come to think that the normal way that planets exist in our universe is that they orbit around a star like our planets orbit around our sun. But over the years, there has been mounting evidence that planets can just exist in the universe, do exist in the universe, not orbiting around a sun at all, not orbiting around a star at all. They're just floating through the universe by themselves. Okay, so this is evidence which has been developed in part by the collaboration of which I'm a part, the Microlensing Observations in Astrophysics. This is a Japan-US-New Zealand collaboration which observes out of New Zealand down at Lake Takapo with the country's biggest telescope. And over the years, we have been making our observations and we have been inferring the presence of starless planets. Planets are just floating their way through the galaxy, not orbiting a star. Now, with the James Webb Space Telescope observations, they have found the same thing. They've actually now got images of these planets. But these images are of planets not just by themselves floating through the galaxy without a star, but they're orbiting around a partner. They have binary planets. Now, understanding how planets form is quite complicated, and we'll just briefly go through it really quick. So you have a big cloud of gas and dust, and it starts to collapse underneath its own gravity, forms a disk, and then little bits and pieces of that gas and dust clump together to form bigger pieces of gas and dust, and they themselves clump together to form progressively bigger and bigger objects. Those progressively bigger and bigger objects have their own gravity, and that starts attracting more bits of gas and dust, and so you slowly start to accrete matter into these big blobs called planetoids, which they then crash into each other and they form planets. And at the center of this gas and dust disk is the protostar, is a big clump of gas and dust, which will eventually become that planetary system's star. Okay, so this is our understanding of how a solar system like our own formed. So where do these free-floating planets come from? Where do these planets who just exist by themselves come from? Well, the theory goes that, okay, you can, in the process of forming a planetary system like our solar system, eject planets. So when these objects are crashing into each other and are forming larger objects, they're all moving around, it's a very dynamic system, you can have gravitational influences or perturbations, which means that some of the stuff just gets flung out of that process. You can have planets being ejected from that protoplanetary disk and start flying through the galaxy by themselves. So this is the theory by which we think, okay, well, if we're finding these planets not orbiting a star, just flying through the galaxy by themselves, then I guess they were formed in a protoplanetary disk, but they were ejected in some fashion, thrown out.
Is it likely that there are more of these objects, or are they quite rare?
This is a standing question at the moment. So when you take your we take these ideas, these observations to theorists who have to sit down and go, okay, right, now we have to come up with a theory of how we eject these planets, then there's still an open question of, well, okay, so if you have end up with a planetary system of, let's say, eight planets and a whole bunch of minor planets like our solar system, in that process forming that planetary system, how many planets or planetoids would have been thrown out during that process? That's an open question. So it varies from not too many to a great deal. So this is an exciting and interesting question that needs to be answered.
To me, this discovery was quite interesting because the distance of stars has always posed a challenge for us in visiting planets outside of our solar system. Now, an obvious question might be, how likely is organic life to form on a planet without an accompanying star?
Okay, so this is a question about the emergence of life, and this is something which we touch on at university here. If you come along to a course called Astrobiology 200, we talk about all those sort of elements which goes into what do you need to have on a world that allows life to take hold. And we start off with the easy question, which is like, well, what's life anyway? And so the whole question about what is life, how do we define it, how would we know it when we saw it? Does it look like us? Does it act like us? Does it smell like us? Or is it something completely different but still has processes that we would recognize as being similar to the life processes that we see here on Earth? They themselves are tricky questions. And then you want to load in the question of, all right, most of the life processes here on Earth, we thought their energy, if you like, or how they managed to become alive from energy received from the sun. So plants that we see around us, they transform solar energy into energy that they can use. More complicated creatures like ourselves, we eat those plants, or perhaps eat the animals that eat those plants, et cetera, et cetera. So we all thought we derived everything ultimately from energy received from the sun. And then later observations, later discoveries in interesting parts of the Earth's surface that we can access, subsurface areas as well, we've found that life can take a hold in a variety of places, places which do not derive ultimately energy from the sun. So these are forms of life called extremophiles, things which like living in extreme conditions. And those extreme conditions could be, for instance, on the bottom of the sea floor near a hydrothermal vent where the energy is actually being produced by the hot water coming from heat processes deep within the Earth, which have nothing to do with energy received from the sun, but ultimately come from leftover energy from the formation of the Earth. We've found other processes which have life existing in extreme cold, extremely acidic conditions as well. So that broadened our understanding of where life processes could take place. So when we take away the one thing that we used to think was the source of energy and the where we derive the energy for life processes on Earth, the sun or a star, and say, oh, actually, no, we've found evidence of life which seems to be quite happy in the absence of a star, then we start asking more interesting questions like, could there be basic life formation taking place, existing, taking hold on a world which does not have energy being received from a host star? So that's not to say that this is absolutely going to happen. Are we going to find life on these sort of sunless worlds? But our understanding of life processes on Earth has expanded our understanding of what life is and where it can take hold, even on our own Earth. And that opens up the questions of, okay, well, now we have a whole range of other world surfaces that we could explore looking for evidence of life within our own solar system, like the icy moons of Jupiter, for instance, and by extension, possibly these ancient worlds, these worlds which have been ejected from their protoplanetary systems, if life processes had started on there, could they be existing in the subsurface near a source of energy that is still remnants in there? We don't know.
That was Dr. Nick Rattenbury on the discovery and photography of new starless planets.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
And we'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Ponsonby Social Club presents Asian Soundscapes, a month of Pan-Asian ecstasy, Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays in October.
The very best local Pan-Asian creatives are set to immerse you in a rich tapestry of Pan-Asian music, comedy and culinary delight.
Featuring Angela Dravid, Club Ruby, DJ Kieran Tahir, Phoebe Rings, Ray Leslie, Scalper and heaps more.
Plus a special kitchen pop-up by Naaman and the Strawberry Pig.
Asian Soundscapes at the Ponsonby Social Club, Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays this October. Tickets available from Under the Radar.
Citizens of Auckland,
prepare for the event of the year. Get your geek on at Armageddon Expo,
New Zealand's most exciting gaming and pop culture event of the year.
Meet stars from Star Trek, The Last of Us, Mandalorian, Walking Dead, Tokyo Ghoul, Tokyo Ghoul, and more. Plus huge gaming displays, collectibles galore, anime, K-pop, cosplay, pop culture, collectibles, and so much more.
Armageddon, this weekend, at Auckland Showgrounds. Tickets on the door or go to iticket.co.nz.
Arcade Radio, Thursday night, 7 to 9pm. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
When I'm in a New York state of mind.
Arcade Radio.
Show me that you're mine, girl.
For all that and a heavy dose of fine tracks, tune in to Arcade Radio. Thursday night, 7 to 9pm, with Mike, Jono, Eddie, Nat, and special guests every week. Arcade Radio. Only on 95 BFM.
Save the Bee. 95 BFM and friends are hosting the mother of all fundraisers at Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, December 20.
Come help the Queen Bee of Auckland alternative music make some sweet honey.
Featuring two stages and an array of 95 BFM associated acts, including
Sheehard playing debut album Churn in Full,
Aroha,
Concord Dawn final ever performance, Delaney Davidson and Marlon Williams,
Ebony Lamb,
Lips,
Princess Chelsea,
The Rock and Roll Machine,
Tiny Ruins,
and Voom.
Save the Bee, a 95 BFM fundraising gig. Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, December 20.
Tickets on sale Tuesday
from Ticketmaster.
Burst into Motat Labour Weekend for Ngā Meru Meru Bubbles.
Get foamy, fizzy and poppy with a weekend of bubble-tastic activities.
You can catch a bubble, paint with bubbles, watch a bubble show or even get inside a giant bubble. Plus heaps more.
Motat will be bubbling over with excitement suited for the whole whānau.
Ngā Meru Meru Bubbles. Find out more at motat.nz.
What was that?
We've just lost the main engine. You said it, Chu.
We have you surrounded. All your spaceship are belong to us. Now, Armageddon, your spaceship. Commandeer it and take it to the Auckland Showgrounds.
Oh, well, that's where we were going anyway.
Oh, can I just catch a ride then? I can put some cash towards gas.
Armageddon, New Zealand's most exciting gaming and pop culture event of the year. And good news, holders of the Cosmic B card, you could win tickets. So keep those Spock ears perked up while listening to 95BFM all week. Armageddon, Labour Weekend, October 20 till 23 at Auckland Showgrounds. Tickets on the door or go to iticket.co.nz.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Research undertaken by the Consumer Advocacy Council has found that adding a best plan notice to power bills could save Kiwis millions of dollars a year. Some countries, like Australia, have already implemented this. To find out more, I spoke to Consumer Advocacy Council Chair Deborah Hart. I started our interview by asking what a best plan notice is and what it would entail.
Best plan notice is a prominent notice on every electricity bill that would tell you the best plan that the retailer has for you and your whānau. So it really will tell you if there's a better plan for you to be on. And we're suggesting that that notice should be on power bills every 3 months.
Does your research show consumers want a best plan notice? And what would it mean for consumers?
Yeah, well, our research shows us that 9 out of 10 people want a best plan notice. Australian electricity retailers already have to display a best plan notice, and we see no reason why it shouldn't happen here too. It will enable consumers to know that they could save money, and they could save money just by changing to a better plan with their own retailer. You know, we know that that could save them, you know, a lot of money and ensure that that money goes into their pockets instead of into retailer bank accounts.
What are the potential savings across the board?
Yeah, we estimate them to be in the millions. The Electricity Price Review, which was released in 2019, thought that consumers were paying $39 million too much per annum from being on the wrong plan. But to give you an idea, and that's, you know, not just being on the wrong plan with their own retailer, but being with the wrong retailer, for instance. But even if 10% of households had $100 worth of savings per annum from being on a better plan, that's $20 million that is overpaid to retailers, and that's a really conservative estimate.
What key features would be a part of a best plan notice?
Really simple. It would just tell you in a prominent box on the front of your electricity bill and prominently displayed in any app what the best plan was for you and your whānau. So it would tell you, we're also suggesting that prominently displayed on your bill should be the critical information that you need to know. And one of those pieces of critical information is what power plan you're currently on. My retailer, for instance, which is one of the big gen tailors, doesn't tell me on my bill what plan I'm on, which makes it impossible for me to go into Power Switch and put in the information that's needed there to see if there's a better retailer for me. Without, you know, having to hunt around and find what my plan actually is.
Do you think the government is likely to implement this, or is it to be done at the level of local councils?
Actually, neither. This is firmly in the hands of the regulator. So the Electricity Authority has a mandate as regards small consumers. That's residential and small business consumers. And it is the one that could regulate to require all retailers to provide a best plan notice to consumers. And we're telling it should. And everyone should be telling the regulator that it should be doing this.
Finally, what can your average Kiwi do to show their support for mandatory best plan notices?
Well, the Electricity Authority at the moment has just closed a consultation on consumer protections, but next year it's going to open a new submission process. And this should be covered in that process. So at that time, we hope all Kiwis are going to get on board and tell the regulator that they want to see a best plan notice on their electricity bills. That'd be a great thing for people to do.
That was Consumer Advocacy Council Chair Deborah Hart on the new best plan notice being recommended to our electricity regulator.
Classic journo question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
Breast cancer affects thousands of Kiwis, particularly women, every year. This year, the New Zealand Breast Cancer Foundation raised funds to purchase a new camper van, which they painted pink and dubbed Pinky. This camper van travels to more remote regions of the country with two nurses on board, helping to screen those for cancer and raise awareness of the importance of early detection. To find out more, I spoke to New Zealand Breast Cancer Foundation Chief Arlene Rayner. I started our interview by asking what the New Zealand Breast Cancer Foundation does.
So Breast Cancer Foundation in New Zealand is the largest breast charity for New Zealanders, and our vision is to see zero deaths from breast cancer. And how we do that is we have four key priorities, which is the first is education and awareness campaigns. And they really do promote the importance of early detection. And then there's research, which is by world-class New Zealand scientists. And what they do is they seek to advance breast cancer detection and treatment. There's support, which we have a team of specialist nurses which help patients get through their treatment and recovery. And lastly, what we do is advocacy, so really looking to improve access to diagnosis, treatment and care.
What is the pink camper van and what does it do?
The pink camper van is brand new. She's a purpose-built education vehicle. And we've been out on the road since 2014 teaching breast health awareness in our iconic retro pink caravan, which we've affectionately called Pinky. Two of our nurses have travelled on board with that to teach education to Kiwis around early detection, why mammograms are so important, how to do self-checks, and also minimise the risk of developing breast cancer. So the aim with the vehicles is to ensure that Kiwis have access to breast health around the country where specialist services aren't readily available. So Pinky, the caravan, is now really old and we haven't been able to get her around very easily. So last year we fundraised for a new vehicle. The new camper van is much bigger. It's bright pink, you can't miss her. It has better technology and is more welcoming and inviting. But the biggest factor is that it's self-drive, which means there's so much more flexibility and we can now get to the most remote and isolated corners of New Zealand where Kiwis need us most.
What are the early warning signs of breast cancer and why is it important to catch them early?
Yeah, so it's important to know that breast cancer isn't just a lump. There are many other signs of breast cancer. So some of the other symptoms include swelling or a thickened area in the breast, upper chest or armpit, an inverted nipple, nipple discharge, crustiness, flaky skin around a nipple, dimples, puckering or dents, or reddened skin like orange peel, and unusual breast pain, or potentially changes to shape of the breast. So what's really important to surviving breast cancer is early detection. If you detect your breast cancer early, there is more chance that the tumour will be small and hasn't spread. And what that means is it makes that easier to treat. So the other thing is mammograms are the best tools that we have for early detection. And so they can detect breast cancer before potentially any of the symptoms are seen or felt. But they aren't recommended for women under the age of 40. So although that cancer in your 20s and 30s isn't common, it does happen. So it's really important that women start being breast aware in their 20s, which means knowing your normal, knowing the normal look and feel of your breasts, checking your breasts regularly. If you notice any changes, get them checked out by your doctor straight away. Don't wait for your next mammogram appointment. If you're aged 45 to 69, please go for your free mammograms every 2 years.
What does a mammogram involve?
So a mammogram involves, it's a screen, it's like an x-ray of your breast. So essentially your breasts are put into a machine, they are compressed slightly to get an accurate image so that breast cancer can be seen. From there, a radiologist will read those essentially mammograms / x-rays in terms of that and provide you any information that you need. There is always a second read done of a mammogram, so that way you're getting two independent assessments to make sure that the diagnosis is correct.
I understand the pink camper van is mainly going to be travelling in the South Island. Where can people who live in Auckland go to get breast cancer screenings?
Yes, so screening in Auckland is done by BreastScreen Aotearoa. It is an opt-in program, so you won't automatically be contacted. If you're age 45, you do need to enrol. Visit their website, Time to Screen, or call 0800 270 200. They have clinics all over Auckland, but they also have mobile screening units that travel around to different locations.
Finally, how can your average Kiwi support those at risk from breast cancer and support the Breast Cancer Foundation?
So each year, around 3,500 women are diagnosed with breast cancer, and 25 men a year are also diagnosed too. So a breast cancer diagnosis can be devastating. It can affect your life in so many ways. Treatment can be difficult to deal with, both physically and mentally. But as I said, the good news is breast cancer is survivable if it's caught early, which is why we're so passionate and determined to spread the awareness around early detection. So if you look at the 10-year survival rate for a stage 1 diagnosis, it's 97% compared to only 71% for a stage 3 tumour. So really what we're saying here and encouraging women to do is early detection can minimise the impacts of going through treatment. The earlier you're diagnosed, the less likely you will need to have invasive and toxic treatment. And for women, that really does mean that you could avoid a mastectomy or avoid having chemotherapy. So we offer support services with a team of specialist breast nurses. So you can contact us at any stage on 0800 226 8773 or you can email us at breastnurse@bcf.org.nz.
That was New Zealand Breast Cancer Foundation Chief Arlene Rayner on their new breast cancer awareness campaign and the goal to have zero deaths from breast cancer.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, attendees of the Palestinian Solidarity March in Auckland, Palestinian Solidarity Network Aotearoa head John Minto, astrophysicist Nicholas Rattenbury, Consumer Advocacy Council Chair Deborah Hart and New Zealand Breast Cancer Foundation Chief Executive Arlene Rayner. Nira hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Bridge.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.